Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. President Donald Trump's decision last year to put tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese imports shocked the system. Over the weekend, the president tweeted that he would impose levies on additional goods, placing even more focus on the conflict between the world's two largest economic superpowers. Learn more in the Frontline NPR joint investigation, Trump's Trade War. It airs tonight, 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV and at pbs.org/frontline. Correspondent and producer Laura Sullivan joins us now on In the Moment. She's one of NPR's most decorated journalists with 3 Peabody Awards and 2 Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Silver Batons. Laura Sullivan, thank you for making time for us on In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's go back in time a little bit because this Frontline NPR investigation, goes back into the archives. And Donald Trump, before he was President Trump, has been talking about trade relationships with China in particular for decades. Tell us about that.
Yes. He's been, so Trump has had sort of one formed idea for the past several decades that it began with Japan in the 1980s, and it switched over to China in the late 1990s and into the 2000s, that the United States has been taken advantage of by these countries, that the trade deficit is a symbol of us losing, the United States losing to other outside forces, other countries. And this is really one of the very few sort of formed opinions that he's held on to for this long. And this is something that really translated into his campaign rallies and when he went on the road in 2016 and really resonated with a lot of people in the United States that the United States has lost to, you know, its manufacturing jobs, and it has lost to other countries, and in this case, China. Since at least for the past 20 years, he's been saying China, and this is, you know, really something that he sees this as very binary. There's a winner and a loser, and the United States is losing.
Where were some of those ideas formed for him before he had, that we know of, political ambitions?
So we talked to a lot of people, a lot of historians and people who knew him back in the 1980s, and this is something that came up when he was in New York City. He was a businessman. He was dealing with a lot of Japanese investors. Japanese investors were buying some of the buildings that he wanted to buy, and he sort of began to see this as an issue that was affecting him, but it was also that he really viewed himself as sort of representing the everyman, you know, the working class American. And you can see this sort of start to come up in all of these interviews, television interviews and appearances, even on Oprah that he was in, where he really starts talking about this issue of the United States worker and United States being taken advantage of. And it stays with Japan for a while until you start seeing it shift sort of gradually over and becoming China. Japan was no longer a threat to the United States, and then suddenly the rise of China was. And the United States transitioned a lot of its manufacturing to China, where they were willing to make things cheaper. And a lot of U.S. businesses took China up on the offer. And Trump has felt that that has been a disservice to the country ever since.
And it's personal to him. He's saying very early on, they're laughing at us. They're ripping us off. He uses the word rape during his campaign rallies to talk about the trade relations.
Yes.
You know, America is being raped by China. Very strong rhetoric.
That's the language he used. Yeah. Yes, that's the language he used.
And it hasn't really become more nuanced than that.
No, in fact, it's never really had a lot of nuance in it. He's been very clear about this from the beginning. And by the time he got onto the campaign trail, he really found an audience for this language the United States has been raped. He said this was the greatest theft in the history of the world. You know, this is very sort of, you know, giant ways of looking at this, very black and white. But inside the audiences of these rallies was real people, real heartland American people who had lost jobs in manufacturing to both automation but also to China. So this really resonated with people who have have experienced in real life what this has actually meant. Now, economists will say in sort of the broader picture, well, this has been good for the United States because it's created all these jobs because products are cheaper. And they've created jobs in other areas. You know, millions of jobs have been added to the U.S. economy because Chinese products are cheaper. However, the U.S. has also lost millions of jobs, and those are actually real people who had their lives upended, and you can see that in the decimation of so many American manufacturing towns.
So once President Donald Trump is the president, he's in the White House, and he assembles around him a group of advisors for this topic. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about those advisors, because those conversations about trade are some of the most contentious that they have.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what's happening in the White House in the early days of the administration.
So once he was elected, he assembled a team of advisors, you know, to focus on China. And he said early on that he was very interested in doing tariffs. And he pulled in people like Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs. He pulled in a hawkish economist named Peter Navarro. He pulled in H.R. McMaster to be his national security advisor. And he pulled in Steve Bannon to be his, you know, chief strategist. And this group very quickly and very early splintered. They were deadlocked over whether tariffs would bring China to heel or would devastate the U.S. economy. And there was very little middle ground between the two. The battle became known as the globalists versus the nationalists. The globalists did not want tariffs. They felt that the United States needed partnerships to deal with China, that tariffs would hurt the economy. The nationalists, like Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, felt that tariffs were the only way to bring China to the table, to bring China, to get them to stop the cyber theft and the hacking, and also to make the trade practices fair. And that by making with adding tariffs, products would be more expensive, and then it would bring back manufacturing in the United States. And this became so contentious between these two groups that they would have these meetings, you know, sometimes in the Oval Office, sometimes in the Roosevelt Room, that at one point, one meeting almost came to blows. You know, Peter Navarro would come in. He loved bringing in big charts, you know, like very glossy pie charts. Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs, which came from Goldman Sachs, which is very data heavy, said that this just drove him nuts, that this was not actual data. He said that Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon didn't bring data to the debate. They only brought pictures. And then Steve Bannon says that is absolutely not true, that Gary Cohn refused to see and acknowledge that China that the United States is at an economic war with China. And it got nasty. Steve Bannon said that these were the, quote, nastiest fights in the White House times 10 of all the other issues that came up.
And Steve Bannon says in this episode, too, that we need these tariffs for national defense. Talk about this sort of notion of a national security emergency and how it ties in to the tariffs and the relationship with China regarding trade.
Yeah. So Steve Bannon wanted to use the idea that this is an economic war with China, and the only way to do that is to levy tariffs and bring China to heel in this way. There were elements to this. They were saying that the United States needs to make its own steel because it cannot be dependent on other countries like China for steel, because that would put the United States at a national security disadvantage if there ever were a war. A lot of people in the military say that that's not entirely a concern that they have, and that there's enough steel making in this country, and the specialized steel making is still in this country. But regardless, this was what he called a secret weapon that he was going to use in order to bring about these tariffs and to make this possible. You know, the nationalists, I mean, the globalists at that time who are anti-tariffs said that this was going to do damage to the United States economy. The globalists like Steve Bannon, the nationalists like Steve Bannon won. The nationalists won, and most of the people involved in this fight have since left the White House.
You spend time in Ohio talking to Americans who are impacted in one way or the other by the tariffs, but you also head to China. When you go to China, what are you hoping to learn?
I think, you know, you get to China and what you see is this incredible country with these, you know, that is just a marvel of how much it has accomplished in the past 20 years, that has eradicated poverty for 300 million people. No country in the world has been able to do a feat like that. And they're so full of pride, and they want to move ahead into what they believe is their future. They, you know, to go from the level of poverty that they were in to becoming the world's second superpower in 3 or 4 decades is unbelievable. They are full of optimism about their future. But there is this darker side to China's rise, and that is the theft of American technology that has come through cyber hacking and unfair trade practices and things like that. In some of the interviews we did, you know, I flat out asked, you know, the top Chinese officials, does China steal American technology? And in these interviews, top officials will look at you right in the eye and say, absolutely not. And then you come home to the United States and you talk to dozens of law enforcement officials, federal officials, you know, longtime careerists, I mean, people with no sort of axe to grind, who say this is the theft of American technology has been vast and extensive and worse than Americans have any idea has gone on.
And
so
yet,
it's hard to reconcile the two.
And yet, these companies who are being pillaged for their trade secrets are also hesitant to stand with
hiding.
The United before President Trump, and we're looking at the Obama administration now as well. Some of those companies are hesitant to take a stand or even have their name spoken in relation to this conflict. How come? What's going on there?
Yes. So what we found is that the American business community has complained about the theft of their technology, but they wanted to keep it quiet. And that put them at a significant disadvantage and the country at a disadvantage for having the ability to handle and manage this problem. Even in the face of outright theft, they hand-tied U.S. officials for the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and even a little bit in the Trump administration, where companies said that they had too much money at stake, that they had a responsibility to shareholders to sort of manage this theft problem quietly. But the impact of that secrecy is really coming to light now. Companies are facing hundreds of millions of dollars in future losses by keeping this secret that ultimately failed to hold China to account and put the United States enforcement agencies years behind where they might have been if they had aggressively pursued China. And they couldn't do it without the companies coming forward. And these companies refused to come forward for years.
Are we in a trade war or are we in a technology war? Let's jump forward, because some people in this documentary say, you know, we're fighting the wrong fight here. We're fighting a fight to go backwards, and China's ahead of us. What are you hearing from folks who are saying what should be done next?
The people that seem to have looked at this situation the most, what they sort of universally say is that the future of whatever happens to both countries is what's going to happen in the technology field. China is aggressively moving forward. They have a 10, 20, 50-year plan of where they want their country to go. And they have the kind of economic model, because they're, you know, they're very top-down, and the government funds all of their industries and what their priorities are. They can very swiftly and easily move their entire country toward they want to be the top of the technology food chain. That is where the United States currently sits. There are a lot of people worried that the United States is not keeping up with that race, and that the United States is starting to lose its edge to China. And a lot of people that we talked to said that this trade discussion is a distraction from where the real work needs to be done, and that is in honing America's ability to stay on the cutting edge and on the forefront of technology in the future.
And you hear that from folks in Silicon Valley, and you also hear it from manufacturing, blue-collar workers who want to be on that cutting edge as well.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And in China, even they don't want to make T-shirts and toys anymore. They want to push that off into other countries. They want to make Boeing engines. They want to make, you know, semiconductors. Yeah. They want they want where the real sort of powerful technology future is.
Right. And semiconductors is an interesting example because of the quant. Talk a little bit before we let you go about just the vast amounts of money that Chinese leaders have to invest in some of this technology right now.
Yeah. So some of the people we talked to in Silicon Valley said that they would have businessmen or investors coming from China that would sit down and say that they had, in one case, $15 billion to invest. I mean, this one of the people we interviewed in the film, and you know, is at the heart of Silicon Valley finance for 35 years, and he had never seen anything like this in his life. And even when somebody, investors would come and say, I have $1 billion. It sort of blew his mind. Nobody has $1 billion without any strings attached. And when he would say, what do you want to invest in? They would say semiconductors. They would say, anything that was sort of like, you know, the high end, you know, future of Silicon Valley and aerospace design, you know, engines, things like that, things that would move, you know, China or the United States forward. And there's a little bit of concern in Silicon Valley that China has simply either bought the companies where they need the technology, or they have invested heavily so they have access to the technology. But there's also a flip side to that where a lot of people in Silicon Valley want Chinese investment. And in some cases, it's really legitimate investment. It is a Chinese company that can actually offer the U.S. company to share. I mean, they're doing well, too. They want to share technology and grow together and do amazing things together, and they have access to money. So there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley who say, let's not go too far with this. You know, and it's kind of the same arguments that almost harken back to the same arguments that the steel industry was having 20, 30 years ago.
What surprised you the most about this work?
I think that the internal battle over this in the White House was surprising to me, that it was as strong and vicious as it was. And to also sort of think about the idea that in a strong and vicious battle like that, only one side won. And now moving forward, regardless of where people fall on the issue of tariff or to not to tariff, there is only one voice in the White House now, and there is no mitigating force that says, let's think through what tariff, you know, adding these incredible increases on Friday of $200 billion in more Chinese products might do to the U.S. economy. The White House is moving forward full steam.
Laura Sullivan has been our guest. Laura, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The Frontline NPR joint investigation, Trump's Trade War, can be seen tonight, 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV and at pbs.org/frontline.